It's your Tech Update Monday on the Larry Mueller Show. Good morning, I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and our guest is Beth D'Angelo. She has over 20 years of experience in IT and is the senior IT specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. She's here for the hour to answer your tech questions, whether they're connecting to the internet, hardware, software. You tell her. Call us 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And Beth, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Good morning, Lee. Thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
And I want to start with connecting to the internet, because I think oftentimes when you go to connect to the internet and you find that there is no internet connection, you think first thought is your internet service provider's probably down, although I don't think that has been the case as often as it used to be these days, or maybe your router or your modem's not working like it should be. But sometimes the internet itself could be stuttering. And I saw this story from a couple of different places about the end of September, when the online security company Cloudflare reported that they had blocked a DDoS attack that was twice as large as anything they had seen on the internet before. Now, there's a couple words in there that I think probably deserve some explanation. And let's start, Beth, with what a DDoS attack is.
Yeah, DDoS. So that's kind of one of the oldest tricks in the book as far as how to gum up the works when it comes to jamming traffic on the internet. It's called a deliberate denial of service attack. So that's what the DDoS stands for. And essentially what it means is someone is using a number of computing resources to send a vast number of requests to something out on the internet, a server or a group of servers that host certain websites or e-commerce platforms, or even a service provider like a Microsoft or a Google, where it then takes down the infrastructure that manages those sites because they can't handle the amount of requests that are coming at it. Used to happen a lot more back in the day. It's a little bit less common now, but it still does happen, as we can see.
Where do all these attacks come from? How are they, in essence, clogging the internet?
So essentially what happens is somebody can create a piece of malware or a virus that goes out to millions and millions of endpoints or devices. Many of them are infected. That infection can then take over some of the resources of that machine and utilize those resources to perpetuate that attack on a specific target. So they're kind of aggregating resources that they're stealing via malware or viruses out on the internet over time.
So this is coming from, is this a byproduct of the Internet of Things? And is there a way that we play a role in these DDoS attacks?
Yeah, I certainly think that the proliferation of devices that are connected to the internet that have somewhat limited security measures built into them, that Internet of Things that you're talking about, you know, could really contribute to an increase of denial of service attacks utilizing resources like that. So if you have, a Ring doorbell camera mm-hmm. on your house, and that Ring doorbell camera connects to the internet via your Wi-Fi service that you have set up in your home, if that Ring doorbell camera somehow is compromised, it could potentially be used, depending on how the virus is set up and how the attack is structured, as another resource to attack a target from. And there are very few, I think, security measures that are built into some of these devices that can prevent that utilization at the device level.
This attack at the beginning of, or at the end of September, rather, was 22.2 terabytes per second. It's just an overwhelming amount that ends up being twice as large as the previously largest attack, which was just early, at the beginning of September. And this was announced by Cloudflare. What's Cloudflare, Beth?
So Cloudflare is a large organization that produces monitoring and intelligence products for more specifically for commercial use in large organizations for essentially monitoring traffic on the internet, looking for activities that look anomalous, out of the ordinary, a whole lot of traffic going towards one destination that is kind of out of line with that normal behavior. It does track internet traffic behavior and create something we call playbooks, where known behavior is logged, and then seeing things that are outside of those kind of known behavior parameters trigger alerts that they can then send out to users of that service to, you know, let them know that something may be taking place that they want to check into.
I'm wondering whether or not, I'm wondering whether or not the "I am not a robot" box that so many of us have to click now online has something to do with the bigger picture here that we've been talking about with these DDoS attacks and Cloudflare's role on the internet. But first, let's get to a call at 1-800-642-1234, where Jennifer in Sturgeon Bay is standing by. Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning.
What do you have for us, Jennifer?
Yes, I'm here.
Yep. Go ahead.
My question is, what sort of tech jobs are going to be really important to fill in the next few years as, you know, someone who's maybe middle-aged wants to change careers, or younger people who are trying to figure out what kind of career to go into that involves tech and computers?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jennifer. I used to think that, you know, being a computer coder would be an avenue into an IT career. But now I see that artificial intelligence is taking over computer coding. Beth D'Angelo, as you look at the landscape for IT opportunities in the not so distant future and down the road, what do you see?
Yeah, I think, Lee, you were pointing in the right direction when you started discussing AI and what the future looks like as far as the landscape of employment within information technology. It is certainly changing, and just those kind of general programming skills, the ability to write code, the ability to test and debug code, those are still really valuable skills that are highly sought after in IT. So if somebody is going down that path, I certainly wouldn't discourage them from continuing. However, AI in the last 2, 3, 4 years has really started to dominate the conversation, and you don't necessarily need to be an expert in how AI is developed or, creating large language models or developing the machine learning techniques for AI itself. But what really is starting to become in demand is folks who actually know how to use these AI tools. So looking towards training and education and opportunities where some of the tools that are being shaped for maybe some specific markets, if you're looking to get into a specific industry, if there are AI tools that are being developed specific to that industry, I would be looking into training and professional development on how to best utilize those tools. So learning prompting, learning stringing together AI prompts to create AI projects that then allow you to kind of develop a framework for creating more work within. And then using some of the automation that is baked into these AI tools that allows you to connect various IT services to each other to create workflows and to really boost people's efficiency and productivity, and to kind of break down some of those processes that for a long time we've had to either switch between different service providers to finish a process, or we've had to insert some manual processes in between to make them work. So really the utilization of those tools, I think, is going to be huge.
I appreciate the question, Jennifer, because I'm sure that there are plenty of people asking it now, both young and old. So thank you for the call. Let's go next to Mary Kay in Kenosha. Mary Kay, good morning.
Good morning. I'd like a question answered about Wi-Fi. When the owners of apartments put in a life station, okay, without your consent, without any written consent, and it's hooked up to their Wi-Fi, is there a possibility there can be a hack and there's microphone and camera capability?
Whoa. Can you explain a little more, Mary Kay?
Yeah, I'd like to hear more about the life station.
Yeah. Well, there were 14, there's 14 buildings. There's hundreds of people, okay, that live in apartments. And the owners put them in August. And they says, we can't deny them. We can't do anything. We can't move them. They put them on our kitchen table. They says they have to stay here. They're hooked up to their Wi-Fi and not to worry about it. They walked out the door. No book with it. No telephone with it. Nothing. But what I don't believe in Wi-Fi. I believe it harasses your sleep. It bothers your sleep. Okay, so I don't have any Wi-Fi in my house because I don't like it. Mm. So what are the tenants' rights?
I'm not sure we're the best to answer that question, Mary Kay, but it is a pointed question, and I think that your best bet might be a tenant resource center in your area to ask about what you can do and what your rights are as a renter. But when it comes to the technology of Wi-Fi, Beth, you can pull back the veil on that a little bit and explain how that works in a way that we can understand it a little better, maybe?
Yeah, essentially Wi-Fi is using really similar radio frequencies to what our folks of us, you know, like me who grew up with landline phones. Some of us had wireless landline phones or cordless phones. Cordless phones operate at a similar frequency as Wi-Fi signals.
Hmm.
So they transmit radio signals through the air that contain data. And then that is received on the other end by a device like your cell phone, your smartphone, or like you're talking about now, this LifeStation medical alert. Sounds like it has the ability to probably send and receive Wi-Fi signals from that device if it is in your home. If it's something that you don't want to have in there, it's certainly something you can take up with the management of your residence. Or like we said, a tenant resource center.
Yeah.
But those signals are going to be traveling through the building, whether or not that device is in your specific apartment. There's really not a good way to block Wi-Fi signals from entering a specific location.
But when you make the comparison, Beth, to a cordless phone, I remember the days when your cordless phone could pick up your neighbor's cordless phone and you guys would have a, share a line for a moment until you switch channels on the cordless phone. And Mary Kay mentioned the possibility of being hacked or having some sort of intrusive device attached to these life stations. Is it possible that these hubs could be commandeered in the same or a similar way to what our wireless phones used to be?
I mean, I can't say that it isn't possible. Mm-hmm. I think it's very improbable. I think that the likelihood of there not being any encryption on the Wi-Fi signal that's being sent from the main hub device that life station is connected to, any real devices that we have coming out, that are Wi-Fi connected in modern times include some pretty high-level encryption for the signal as it travels. So it's not like the old cordless phones where those were really unencrypted, raw radio signals, where if you were running at the same frequency as someone else's phone and you were near enough to each other, you might be able to pick up each other's calls. That doesn't happen anymore with encryption.
Mary Kay, I hope you find the answers you're looking for, and sorry we couldn't be of more help today. Our guest is Beth D'Angelo. She's worked in IT for more than 20 years now. She's a senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology for your Tech Update Monday on The Larry Mueller Show. And we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us anytime to talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News. I'm just saying, just because we all have a camera in our cell phone doesn't make us all photographers. So we'll spend the next hour on The Larry Mueller Show talking about how you can get the best picture. You know, the one that is worth a thousand words. We'll talk to an owner of a camera shop in Oshkosh and a photojournalist who has been around the world next hour. So I hope you can stay with us right now. Beth D'Angelo, our guest, senior IT specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, with your Tech Update Monday, answering your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. We'll go to Kathy in Oconomowoc next. Kathy, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I've got a question about, I get an error message on my computer when I try to go online. Now, this doesn't happen all the time. And at first, I thought it had something to do with my new router. because it happened with my old computer, and I've got a new computer, so I don't know if it's the router or if it's my antivirus program, but I come up with this error message, DNS address can't be found. And when I'm trying to go and put in a web address of something I'm looking for online, and sometimes I can get on the internet, no problem. I have contacted my antivirus company, and they helped me out for a while, it seemed like, unless it just happened to be timing with me getting onto the internet, and they had used, I let them go through my computer and change things on it and take out the antivirus program and then put it back in. And then it seemed to work for a while, but it might be a timing thing when I'm going online. And now the DNS address can't be found is coming back again.
Kathy, what web browser do you typically use?
Windows 11.
Okay. Beth, the DNS underscore address, something I've seen before myself, but not consistently.
Yeah, so a couple of different things could be happening, and Lee, you started to hit on it. One of the points I was going to make as far as the browser that you're using, sounds like you're using the built-in Microsoft Edge browser that comes with Windows 11, and that's certainly a viable option and something you should be able to use without getting that error. The thing I would try first would be to download another browser and see if you get the same error going to the same website with a different browser.
Which one would you suggest,
something
Beth?
Like, Chrome is a great option. I use Chrome every day. That's a great one to start with. It's real simple. It's not very different from Edge as far as the user interface, so it won't be a big change to try it out. But I would see if you get the same response when you try it in a different browser. That'll let you kind of rule out the browser as the issue. So if you are able to get to that same address with a different browser, then there may be something wrong with the Microsoft Edge install on your computer. But you did mention that you have a new computer, and this is something that was happening on the old one and is now also happening on the new one. So that, you know, points me in a little bit of a different direction. That maybe your security software, your antivirus software, if you have the same software on the old one and the new one, that may be causing the issue. And I would try disabling it on the new computer and going to the same address to see if it resolves. If you disable that security software and you're able to get to it, then we know that your security software is somehow blocking access to whatever website you're trying to get to, and it may be something you need to take up with that vendor.
I hope that helps, Kathy, and thank you so much for your call. We'll go to Jack and Merrimack next. I should have started with this, Jack. I should have started with this today because I think that you, me, and others are all thinking about it. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. The first question that I have has to do with system updates. I have a Mac, and it has a whole bunch of really high-quality, expensive 32-bit software on it. And the latest Mac updates do not recognize 32-bit software. It would cost me thousands to redo things like Microsoft Office or the entire Adobe suite, the full Photoshop, the whole publication thing, the whole work. So I don't know if there's any answer to this other than to keep my old system and limp through some of the websites that don't recognize that software anymore. Is there any answer to this?
That is interesting because, as I understand it, most software these days comes in 16-bit or 32-bit, and it seems to be moving more towards a 32-bit software structure. But I had not heard that a Mac and Apple update would eliminate that 32-bit software from working, Beth?
Yeah, so this is kind of a recent thing, like you mentioned, to the Apple iOS update. So it has been for a long time that 32-bit app compatibility was pretty standard in most operating systems, and 64-bit was kind of the upgraded, more powerful processing version. So a lot of more secure apps were requiring 64-bit, which meant you needed a 64-bit operating system in order to run them. And then Microsoft has, with Windows 11, I think they still offer a 32-bit and a 64-bit version. Hmm. However, Apple has now deprecated 32-bit, which means they're considering it end of life.
Wow.
And moving everything as of June towards 64-bit applications. So as that happens, newer applications that come out for the Mac OS are likely to be released in that 64-bit platform and not compatible with an older 32-bit operating system.
What's Jack going to do with all his 32-bit software?
Keep the old OS. Don't update to the new version.
Yep.
It is going to be likely end of life for security updates, so I would make sure you've got some third-party antivirus and security software on that particular machine. And if you want something that is more up-to-date for running, you know, things that you'd be worried about running on a less secure machine, I would look to upgrading your hardware, getting a new Apple.
Speaking of end-of-life security updates, tomorrow is the big day for Windows 10 from Microsoft. They have, as I understand it, will not be offering security updates for Windows 10 operating system moving forward. And there are plenty of people with hardware and computers that don't have what they need to upgrade to Windows 11. What are folks supposed to do who are stuck with Windows 10 after tomorrow, Beth?
Yeah, it's still going to work.
Okay.
It's not like it's just going to stop functioning after tomorrow. So you'll still be able to use your PC that's running Windows 10 just like you always did. End of support, what that means is that Microsoft is no longer going to be providing technical support for any issues. So if you contact Microsoft with a problem with Windows and you're still running Windows 10, they're not going to help you out. They're also no longer going to be releasing any software updates for it. So any bugs that are existing in Windows 10 are going to continue to exist. And then no more security updates or fixes. So as new security vulnerabilities are discovered, they won't be releasing patches to fix those vulnerabilities.
This, Beth D'Angelo, our guest, senior IT specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. It's a Tech Update Monday on the Larry Mueller Show. And it brings me to the bigger picture we've seen recently about the debate over data centers. Because as Jack brings up, hey, my stuff, it cost me thousands of dollars, but it's going to be made obsolete by the people I bought it from. Windows 10 users wondering how long they'll be able to hold on to the hardware they have that can't upgrade to Windows 11. We have stories at WPR.org about the data centers and the push and pull and debate over data centers that are looking to come to Wisconsin, build here, use our energy and our water, and then provide access to the Internet of Things and artificial intelligence. But there seems to be a big debate about these data centers. And one of the issues that I wonder from your perspective about, Beth, is the obsolescence of technology and how that plays into the debate over the to build or whether or not to build or not to build data centers in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I hadn't really thought of it much in the sense of the, you know, how quickly things obsolesce in our fast-paced technology world now, that building things out of brick and mortar seems to be kind of a bad investment to a community. It feels like that's the trend as far as technology goes. A lot of promises that are made by the time something is built can no longer be fulfilled because the market has moved on. So that is a big risk that I think communities take when they are going all in on allowing big tech companies to build these massive data centers close to or within their communities.
When they're building these data centers, I mean, aren't they building it with some of the similar chips and technology that we have at home? What's going on inside the black box, Beth?
Well, so data centers essentially are a large warehouse for computer hardware. What usually populates those data centers is a lot of racks full of servers. And those servers, you know, depending on what the data center is housing, let's say, for instance, it's an AI company, usually it's going to be a lot of processing power. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have thousands and thousands and thousands of processors running in a building all at one time, processing data that generates a whole lot of heat, requires an awful lot of power, and kind of leaves a bit of environmental calamity in its wake. So there are a lot of consequences to building these huge server farms and the resources that they consume and the waste that they leave behind.
And the question about how long the technology that's put inside there will last.
Exactly. I mean, it's going to have to be updated. Well, thankfully, hardware tends to follow a little bit of a slower cycle than software.
Okay.
As far as the generations of technology. So chipsets aren't, you know, turning over in major leaps and bounds as far as the changes of the physical technology. But what is changing very quickly is software and platforms where things are existing and living and access to them.
When you talk about these data centers having thousands and thousands of processors, how many processors does my PC have?
Usually it's typically just one.
Okay.
sometimes you might have a dual core processor, so you might have two. You may have a quad core processor, which has like four core chipsets on a single processor head. But usually your computer has one central processing unit, that's your CPU.
Mm-hmm.
A server likely has more than that, because it's going to be handling a lot more traffic. It's going to be doing a lot more input output. There's going to be a lot more demand put on that server as a resource than would be on just your regular laptop at home. So that's when things start to grow exponentially, where you can have a single server that has, you know, tens, dozens, hundreds of core processing units within it.
Oh, wow. Let's go back to your questions now at 1-800-642-1234 with our guest, Beth D'Angelo, on this Tech Update Monday on the Larry Mueller Show. Perry and Oconto, good morning.
Hello, and hi, Beth. My question is this on routers. I have an old system. I'm one of those holdouts that can't up anymore, but I have a router, and I'm hooked up to DSL, so I'm way back in the Stone Age, but I got two routers. They're exactly the same, and I don't use Wi-Fi. I just plug in direct to a desktop, and that's what I like using.
Sure.
But if I have a second router that's never been used, and I'm not sure if I'm having router issues or not, or how I could even tell, but could I just plug the new one into the plugins and just take out the old one, and they're just exactly the same?
Exactly the same, but you may have had some setup for that old router back in the day, Perry. Do you remember anything about how you had to set up that router or what happened when you plugged it in?
It's been a long
time. All right, so for that, we go to Beth D'Angelo for our answers. And I dread the...
I'd never be able to remember how I did it in the first place. I would have to go back through it, too. I get it. Even if it was last year, I'd still have to go through and reverse
right.
engineer what I did the first time, because, of course, I don't write it down. But here is a good tip. If you want to try that, I would suggest plugging the new router in and giving it a go. But before you do that, I would go out on the internet and I would search the make and model of the router you're using, and download a copy of the manual if you don't have it still, or if it's a, you know, just a file, a PDF version of the manual for that piece of equipment, so you can look up if there is anything you need to do to configure it, or if it just works out of the box. And then you can write down what you need to write down from the old router and set it up on the new one. Or it may tell you that it's just plug and play and you're ready to go when you plug it in, but...
But if it had a login and password, Beth, and you didn't set up that login and password, doesn't that make it vulnerable to be employed by those DDoS attacks that we were talking about earlier, those denial of service clogging the internet arteries?
Oh, you're serving me up a great security softball here. So I'm going to make a plug for any time you set up a new router in your home with internet service, that you go into the administrative site for that router, and there will be information on how to do that within the manual that comes with your router. It tells you how to get to the admin page or the admin site for your router. Please go into that and set a username and password for the administrative control or access to that router. If you don't, most routers have a default. Often the username is admin and the password is blank, or the password is admin. It's very easy to find this information if somebody knows what type of router you have. It's very easy for them to just try a few passwords and find the right one. And then they have control over everything connected to your Wi-Fi in your home. So please, 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 when you put a new router in place, or if you have a router and you've never done this, take a look at that documentation, see if it has a default username and password. Try going to that site with that default username and password. If it works, likely your router is vulnerable to compromise.
Is this why I'm always having to prove that I am not a robot on the internet that seems to be increasingly proliferating with robots?
I mean, it's not necessarily the reason, but it's kind of, well, it's a similar, I guess,
what's going
area
on there?
Of thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're talking about the I am not a robot. Tell me, you know, which boxes contain a bus.
Pick the motorcycles. Yeah.
Or, you know, complete this puzzle. Yeah, it's fun. At first, I thought it was just my browser trying to play some fun games with me, but it's actually a real reason for it, and not me just trying to, you know, convince my browser that I am not a robot.
What's the reason?
So, yeah, really, it's a security measure, and what it's designed to do is to prevent bots, which are kind of just an automated AI agent, as we call them, that can access things on the internet by, you know, it's programmed to do so. It's trying to access websites to do whatever. This is a defense mechanism for that website to tell whether or not whatever is trying to access its resources is a human being trying to access it or a bot trying to access it. And it does that actually not by whether or not you know if something is a bus, but by the behavior of your mouse and your cursor and how you click on things.
Oh, isn't that
weird?
It can
tell that you're human based on behavior patterns rather than a bot that is trying to emulate behavior patterns.
And the purpose of this is to try to control the traffic to these sites so that it's actual human beings who are visiting or engaging on these sites and not just some online automation.
Some website and creates 100,000 fake accounts.
Yep.
Because it's programmed to do so, and it can trick the website into thinking it's 100,000 people doing that rather than just a single bot.
So we're going to have to, I imagine, going forward, continue to prove that we are indeed not robots.
Correct.
Jim in Middleton emailed us. He wants to know if virus protection services like Trend or McAfee stop potential threats after Windows 10 is no longer supported by Microsoft, which is slated for tomorrow.
Yeah, I believe they're still going to be releasing updates for whatever version of antivirus software you have. It's not tied to the version of Windows that you're running, but what may happen is as new versions of that software are released, that those will not be released with backwards compatibility to Windows 10. So you may not be able to upgrade in the future.
Beth D'Angelo, our guest, it's our Tech Update Monday, and your questions are welcome at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. And we still have to get to this dead internet theory and what's behind it and whether or not it could come to fruition. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and it's your Tech Update Monday with Beth D'Angelo. She's a senior IT specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology and answering your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Elizabeth in Baraboo next. Elizabeth, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you. What do you have for us today?
So you guys were just talking about the CAPTCHAs to prove that you are not a bot to
yes.
access certain websites. And I have my security settings up pretty high on my browsers. I use some like anonymization on Firefox to
sure.
prevent tracking. And I will fail those not a bot every time. And there are certain websites I just can't access because of it. So I'm wondering, how do I get around that? And is there a happy medium for those of us who are concerned about privacy and security?
Absolutely. And Elizabeth, are you sure you're not a bot?
No, you know, I wonder sometimes.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Beth, what can Elizabeth do?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things you can try if that issue keeps happening. And, you know, it usually centers around how your browser is collecting things like cookies and is tracking specific things. And if you have your privacy settings kind of dialed in really stringent, it could block some of the mechanisms that are being used to display or to relay that CAPTCHA information. So it's kind of counterintuitive. Your security is negating their security. you know, it's like a double negative. But a couple of things you can try in your browser to stop that from happening would be clearing the cache and the cookies, which is probably a setting that you've got set up to do automatically when you close your browser. But if it isn't, I would go in and clear that out just to clear out any junk that might be creating the problem. If you have any browser extensions turned on, I'd try turning those off to see if it removes the problem. And if you have anything set to, like, do not track for Cloudflare access, I would turn that off in your privacy settings because they have some privacy settings set to specific sites or extensions. And if you have the do not track setting turned on, it may block that Cloudflare access.
So Elizabeth's security is blocking the internet security and it negates both, which brings us to the dead internet theory, Beth D'Angelo. Yeah. Can you explain? this is how the internet dies. Beth, explain the theory for us.
It's actually not how the internet dies, which you'd think, you know, just all of our security negating everything and nobody can get to anything would be a pretty good explanation for why the internet is dead or dying or why people are saying that. But it's actually, it's a totally different topic.
Huh.
And a really interesting one at that. It's really more related to, again, AI, which is kind of the topic of all IT conversation these days. But the theory posits that the internet is kind of dead or is in its last death throes due to the fact that a lot of the activity and content that's out there now, including a lot of social media accounts and posts, are really predominantly being created and by like automated artificial intelligence agents or bots. So they're created rapidly with AI-generated content, and they're really just designed to farm engagement, to get engagement, to get clicks, to get likes, to get comments.
But then the engagement's coming from other automations, so that the automation, these artificial intelligence, these bots or robots are online, they're generating content, they're replying to themselves, they're commenting to each other, but all of a sudden there's no human beings in the mix.
And then it's dead.
How do we know when we reach the dead internet?
I guess when no one's out there, no physical people are actually using it anymore. It's just things. I think that may be what the Internet of Things is talking about, where it's just the things using it and not the people.
Well, I hope they like our post, Beth.
They're not ours anymore. They're posting.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh. I know. It's crazy.
But there is some
truth.
Really, I mean,
like, there's some truth to it.
Yes.
And it's really about understanding that when you're using popular platforms like TikTok and Facebook and Instagram and whatever else the kids are using these days, if those particular platforms use ads to generate revenue, then the content within those platforms is probably going to be or become dominated by AI-generated content.
That's just a fact.
Huh.
Say that again. So if it's an advertising and content that at some point we are moving towards the automation of all of this.
Yes.
Okay. And that would be a dead internet.
Clicks equals revenue.
Yeah.
Right. Clicks equals ad sales equals revenue. Generate more clicks. Create more content to generate more clicks. Automate the generation of content to create more clicks, to create more ad revenue, to create more money.
But the clicks are coming from inside the internet.
At some point, well, and that's why they have CAPTCHA, so that they can tell you're not a robot. So it may be that we have to use a CAPTCHA for everything we interact with going on, or there may need to be some other mechanism for determining that it is a person and not a bot that is interacting with some form of content or who is producing some form of content. I don't know what that looks like, but I think that may be the next step that we're looking at.
If that's the case, I feel sorry for Elizabeth, and the internet is dead for her. Well, let's get back to your questions with the time we have left. Mary and Madison, we'll go to you next. Good morning.
Good morning. Over the weekend, in the process of trying to print out a series of bank statements using the printer symbol, suddenly I couldn't it wouldn't allow me to print anymore. So, but my I can print a test sheet off of my printer. Mm-hmm. I can print, if I download a document and use the Control P to print, okay, I'd like to go and print off the puzzles from the daily e-newspaper.
Yeah.
Using, again, that printer symbol.
Well, this to me, Mary, sounds, yeah, it sounds like if you're able to print from your computer but not from your web browser, that maybe it's your web browser that's disconnected to your printer, but it sounds like your computer is connected to your printer. Your printer is printing. So I feel like, Beth, we've sort of narrowed down the place where there could be a problem.
Lee, are you looking for a new job?
Hey,
you can use people like you with your troubleshooting
skills.
Beth,
I want you to know I was a computer science major for 3 semesters. Three.
I did not know that, Lee, but I really like where your brain is going, and I wouldn't have anything different to say. It sounds to me also like it's your browser that's having trouble, and it may not. A good way to test it is, instead of using that little printer icon, would be to go to the actual file menu of your browser. If you click on file and drop it down, there should be a print option in that file menu, and click on print and see if it pops up a print dialog window where it actually asks you, you know, if you want to print this thing and how many pages of it.
And when you go into that dialog, you may find that your printer's been disconnected from your web browser, but it should be an option there because your computer already recognizes it, as I understand it. The other option I would think, Beth, is if you could download that content or save the web page to your hard drive, that way you could bypass the printer option in your web browser and just print directly from the file that you saved to your hard drive, which sounds like still works for Mary.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Definitely, you could try downloading the file and then opening it in whatever program the file was created in. It sounds to me, though, you did mention these are bank statements that you were trying to print, and likely those are opening up in a PDF.
Mm-hmm.
Inside your browser. So it may be that the PDF extension isn't working properly. Instead of opening the PDF in your browser, your suggestion of downloading it and then opening it, Lee, may kind of go around if that add-in or that link to the Acrobat PDF reader isn't working properly.
So, yeah, if you don't have the free Adobe Acrobat reader, I believe that might be something you could download, and it should not cost you a dime.
Nope, you can download it. And in fact, when you download the file, often Adobe will take you to a screen if you don't have the reader downloaded already.
Okay.
It'll take you to a screen to download it right away.
Yep, it sounds like you're close, Mary, and maybe just a few clicks away, whether that's in your file menu, whether you can save the PDF, or maybe you need to download the Adobe Acrobat Reader, which is for free and will not cost you any money. Which brings us to Rich's email from Chippewa Falls. Rich has the basic McAfee computer protection on his home PC, but McAfee keeps suggesting that Rich needs their many extra services beyond the basic for charge. How can you tell what extra services you need, and is the basic service enough for a home PC, Beth?
Yeah, I'm just taking a look at McAfee's various subscription plans that they have right now and what they all contain. It looks like their basic plan is also called the Essential.
Mm-hmm.
And it does, let's see, it does some identity protection. It does VPN, it does antivirus. So if you upgrade to their premium, you end up with some identity monitoring. Oh, no, you have that in the... Oh, what do you get that you don't have?
You get upsold.
Scans. You get scans. personal data clean. Oh, yeah, okay. So they're with their premium upgrade, they're trying to get you to buy into a service that looks online for account and personal data of yours and cleans that off the internet.
Which I imagine if you'd been hacked or your identity had been stolen may be of value, but if you are just using your online PC, you recognize that they're just looking to make a little money and may not be in your best interest to upgrade.
Yeah, I think if you're concerned about your digital information being out on the internet, then you may want to sign up for that service to see if that works for you. But I don't know if it's worth an extra It looks like it's an extra $10 a year. To do that. And maybe it's worth it to try for a year.
Yeah. Let us know what you think, Rich, and thank you for the email. Let's go to Scott in Kenosha next. Scott, we're running short on time, but wanted to make sure we got to you. Thanks for holding on.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Great.
So this question might be a little bit deep for you. I'm not sure, but I'm a sports director here in Kenosha, and we produce and direct all the high school sports.
Yeah.
So like high school football and basketball and stuff. And what we do is we stream it live. And so I'm running into a problem with my streaming device. I have connectivity. I have my own network. And so I have a Wi-Fi router, and I have bars. But from time to time, I keep losing my stream. Is there anything you could do to help me with that?
What are you using for a streaming device?
So I'm using something called a JVC Pro HD, which takes multiple cameras and microphones and inputs them, and then that talks to my laptop, which streams via YouTube.
Okay. All right. I'm just taking a look at this particular product to see if there's any like known issues out there with it specifically. So that camera streams directly to your Wi-Fi access point, and then you have computer connected on the same Wi-Fi. I would think maybe distance could be an issue if the device itself isn't very close to your Wi-Fi access point, you might be losing some of the signal. So that may drop it. Pretty much anything that may disrupt a Wi-Fi signal in any other device.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I would walk around the area and see where your signal dips.
Well, and I'd wonder if there is a way to plug in actually and use your cables to bypass Wi-Fi, because that can be intermittent. And if you're looking to stream online, you'd want as pure of a internet connection as possible. So a Cat 5 cable.
Or at least like, or a mesh Wi-Fi system to just increase your signal and your coverage.
Yeah, which I understand budgets may be limited for high school football in Kenosha, Scott, and really appreciate what you're doing. And would like an update next month if you're available and let us know how that goes. I, with the time we have left, Beth, I want to ask you about, and we just have a couple of minutes, backup, storage backup, because data loss horror stories are the worst horror stories, and you only need to hear one to know what to do. Where should I go with my data? Should I get external hard drives? What are these network-attached storage? Should I rely on the cloud? What's my best bet?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple different ways you could go. Certainly, I don't think you need to go so far as like a network-attached storage device unless you are backing up an awful lot of data and you want to spend a lot of money. But if you're just a standard user with a couple of computers or a laptop and a desktop or, you know, 3-4 devices in your house that you want to back up, I use a cloud service called Carbonite. I've been using it for many years. Mm-hmm. It's a cloud backup. I use it as a scheduled backup, and it does what we call intermittent backups. So it only backs up data that has changed since the last time it was backed up. So I'm not sending a whole lot of stuff every time.
And does that do it automatically for you?
Yes, it does. So you just set up the schedule that you want it to happen. You tell it what you want it to back up, when you want it to do the backup. And it does it for me, and then it just sends me a notification letting me know if it's been successful or if there are any failures or any errors.
What about free cloud services like Google's Drive or Microsoft's, what is it, OneDrive?
I would only use them for things you need to access on a regular basis from multiple devices.
Okay.
That's really for like active data cloud storage that you need to be able to get to from wherever you are. If we're talking about backing up like all of your photos and videos and everything that's on your hard drive, you definitely don't want to use a cloud storage service for that. It's going to get very expensive very quickly.
And you use Carbonite. And Beth, I apologize. Yep. We're out of time, but I want to thank you so much for yours today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Lee. Great to talk to you.
It was a pleasure. Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And we'll have your tech update again on Monday next month. Coming up, we spent an hour figuring out how to take the best photographs, how to capture that moment in a way that is worth 1,000 words. We'll start with a camera shop owner on Main Street in Oshkosh and then talk to a photojournalist from Oshkosh who has gone around the world with the help of his camera. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. The Kinks. on Wisconsin Public Radio and the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and I suppose I get a little bit jealous sometimes when I see a good photograph that does what my words can't. All I have for you are these disembodied words, and hopefully they make some sense at some point. But sometimes when you look at a photograph, there are no words necessary to tell an entire story, capture a moment, and yet somehow capture a sense of being, something inside all of us. What is it about photography? And that's where we spend our next hour here on the Larry Mueller Show. A question's about the gear that you use, whether it's your cell phone or a DSLR camera or a mirrorless camera. What you do to frame a photograph to make it tell the story that you intend? Are you a photographer? If so, what kind of gear are you using? And are you looking for an upgrade? Send us your questions. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. Our conversation starts with the owner of Camera Casino on Main Street in Oshkosh. Jay Rashman joins us. And Jay, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Well, thanks, Lee. Glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about how you fell in love with photography. What's your story about how you came to become the owner of Camera Casino on Main Street?
Well, I worked at it back in the 70s. I worked at a drugstore that had a photo department, and I eventually became manager of a mall that had a camera store, and I just enjoyed working with it, and I enjoy helping people get, you know, photography is so neat because you go through so many things in life, like the person's first child, the first Holy Communion, and all the way on up, you can just, you become part of their history, and I just really enjoyed it.
You become part of their history, and if I'm doing the math right, that history amounts to 50 years plus, Jay?
52 years, yeah.
But who's counting? So over that half century plus, what have you seen change? What's it been like inside a camera store over the last half century, Jay?
Well, I think the biggest change is when it went from film to digital, you know, and I think years ago it was strictly film, and they had magazines. So if you wanted to order something online, the magazines were always probably 60 days behind and coming out with a new product. Well, then all of a sudden you have the internet came in there, and that's almost instant. So now camera stores had to deal with that, and then of course the last is the cell phone, which is, you know, if you ask people, about 98, maybe it's even higher than that percent, say, well, I take my pictures only with my cell phone. And that's what we hear on a daily basis.
So what's the argument for grabbing an old-fashioned camera or a digital camera, a new camera, and going out there and capturing what you see and the moments that are important that you need to capture for yourself?
Well, I think, Lee, the question probably would be, what are you trying to achieve from your pictures? In other words, if you're going out there and saying, I really like to go and film some wildlife, and there's some swans over here, and I want to get a close-up. I saw some pictures in a magazine, and I want to duplicate that. Well, you're not going to do that with a cell phone. You're going to need a DSLR or a mirrorless, and you need a long lens. Or if you say, my son is playing football, and it's a lot of night games, and the stadiums are kind of dark, and you need an action because you want to stop the shutter down to a 250th of a second minimal, you need a fast lens. And these are the things that a cell phone can't give you, along with there's a lot of filters that can enhance your picture and make things, you know, much better. And you have better chances of doing more cropping and editing with a DSLRs and mirrorless than you do with a cell phone.
Jay, when I think of taking a picture, I think of the frame. You know, what am I capturing in that image? I think of focus. What am I focusing on in that image? But some of the other technical aspects are you mentioned aperture and shutter speed. How large is the hole that's going to let the light in? And how fast am I going to snap that picture? But those aren't things that you find on a cell phone.
I kind of missed that. You said you find them or you don't find them?
You do not find aperture and shutter speed on a cell phone.
Right. That's exactly correctly what you're saying. And that's what, you know, keeps our customers coming back because they become frustrated with some of their pictures. Maybe it's their son's senior year in high school and they want memories that'll last and all that kind of stuff. So they're willing to make that investment for just that 1 year. Or maybe they'll come and say, can I rent the camera and rent the lens? Because this is so important for me. This is his or her senior year.
Camera Casino does have rentals, right, Jay?
That we do.
Yeah, absolutely. So if it were just a moment, if it's an event, you can certainly. And I had to laugh at you when you were talking about the capturing football games on your cell phone, because I've received a few of those from family. And it's always a little bit difficult to make out who I'm supposed to be cheering for or what I'm actually seeing. So I can relate to that completely. You mentioned some of these, some of the types of cameras that are available at Camera Casino in Oshkosh. And let's start with DSLRs. DSLR stands for what, Jay?
Well, basically, it's your regular digital SLR, which means single lens reflex. You can take lenses and put different lenses on them. These all have DSLRs, all have optical viewfinders, and they have a mirror and a prism. So every time, you know, you look through it, this little mirror has to pop up and give all the information from the sensor to the camera. And it does it in really quick time. But the mirrorless is just exactly what it means. They don't have that. So they have electronic viewfinder, and they show the digital image as it's going to appear on the picture. So the advantage of the mirrorless over the DSLR is, first of all, it's going to be smaller and lighter, and it's going to focus faster. It's going to have a faster frame rate. So you're going to get better tracking, like if you're doing birds or athletes or race cars and stuff like that, and you're going to have much better video. And then when you even go into mirrorless, there's two type of mirrorless cameras. There is the full frame and the APS. And the difference is most people that would buy a full frame probably are getting paid for their work, like they're professional photographers. They do weddings and all that, because they're always going to be a little wider field of view, and they'll have a shallower depth of field, but they're also more expensive and they're going to be heavier. So the ones that we sell the most are the APS version, and theirs are smaller, lighter weight, less expensive. And of course, the big thing with the APS is you have what we call a crop factor. And with Canon, it's 1.6. You multiply the end of the lens by, and the Nikon and Sony, it's 1.5. To give you an idea, if you bought a 400-millimeter lens on a full frame, it would be a 400-millimeter lens. That's going to be a very powerful lens. But if you put it on the APS, it would then become a 640-millimeter. You know, so you gain 240 millimeters. And if the same thing with a 600-millimeter on a full frame, and it's 960 on an APS. So people that are doing wildlife, a lot of times they want to go APS for that reason, and because they want more power.
How hard is it to take the leap from taking pictures on your cell phone to moving towards a DSLR or mirrorless camera, Jay?
Well, I'll tell you, these cameras are so easy. You know, you can't really make a mistake, because number one is, if you don't know anything, they have what they call an automatic position. You just put it on auto. You're not even loading film, so you can't say, oh, it didn't turn out because I loaded the film wrong. Is all you do is you put it on automatic and you shoot. Now, the problem with all things in life is that they can make it too complicated. You know, it's like I get a remote control for my television. I just want to know how to change the channel. And I want to know exactly where is the volume on it. And I look at these 30 buttons on here, and if I'm using it at bedtime and the lights are out in our bedroom and I can't find anything, usually I disconnect the channel I was on. And so it's very frustrating. And that's the same thing with a lot of the cameras that we sell. They have all these things in case you want to do that. But you don't have to do anything. You can grow into these cameras. And that's what we're there at the store. You know, I always say to our people, now, don't say too much, because you'll be with the customer for 7 hours. Chances are he might get a parking ticket by the time he gets out of there and be mad at us. Okay.
Jay Ratchman's the owner of Camera Casino on Main Street in Oshkosh, taking us through some of the latest gear and whatever you have, how to grab your best pictures. And when you take a picture, Jay, what are you thinking of when it comes to capturing that story, telling that story in a single frame?
Well, you know, I hope to blow that picture up. I don't want to take a picture and just say, oh, I took a picture, now I'm going to get rid of it right away and delete it. You know, I want to save it, and I want to say, you know, I might need that for, maybe the wall at home or something like that. And so I look at the angle I want to film at. I look at whether there's a backlight to it or everything else. I look at can I improve that picture with my f-stop? which is your aperture. Can I blur it out, maybe go to 2.8 or something like that? And or do I want to give more more in focus by going to an F11 or an F16? So and really, it all depends on that.
So when you're talking these f-stops, you're talking about the size of the hole that lets the light in through the camera, and a different f-stop would produce different pictures in what way, Jay?
Well, let's say somebody was like 10 feet. We just use an example. Let's say they were 10 feet from you, and you were taking pictures, and you had your camera set at 1.8. You would have a focus of probably everything would be in focus from, let's say, 9 feet to 11 feet, okay? Mm-hmm. So that's pretty shallow. So if you're trying to say, oh, there's a picture of me in front of the Eiffel Tower, I probably wouldn't want, 1.8, because you'd say, what's that blur of metal behind there? You know, so if I go to F11, I'm going to probably, even again, I'm still at 10 feet, let's say, mm-hmm. everything would be in focus from probably 4 feet to, let's say, 150 feet. So that gives you everything.
And that aperture then creates not just the focus of the story that you're telling in that picture, but also then the depth that you get, the three dimensions that it presents within this 2D picture.
Yes, absolutely. You're right on there, Lee.
Yeah, I love it. And so then let's go to shutter speed then. And tell me, Jay, a little bit about what shutter speed means towards the end product of a photograph.
Well, first of all, the shutter speed is the most important. There's three things that make a picture, okay? It's ISO, shutter speed, and aperture. Those are the three things. So I always tell people, that they say, what's more important? And I say, think of the number 6. Give me two numbers that equal 6. And one person might say 3 and 3, another might say 5 and 1, and the other might say 2 and 4. They're all right on the final answer. But as I look at it, shutter is the most important. Because if you're filming like an auto race or even a hockey game or something like that, and you're at you decide that you're going to go at a 5, or let's say you're at a 30th of a second, every one of your pictures will be blurred. So therefore, you can't use F16 because you took some class somewhere, and the guy said there's going to be a lot of depth of field, with a F16, but he didn't tell you about you're only going to have every picture's blurred. So you got to get the shutter speed appropriate. A good shutter speed for like hockey would be between a 250th and a 500th.
Right, something about as instant as possible. But I have seen photographs where they include some of those trails. I've seen some nature photographs, some star photographs, where they keep that shutter speed open for a while, and you get these tracers that are another photograph entirely and tell a different story entirely.
Oh, entirely, yeah. And that's why some people will buy nutridensity filters, because they want to keep the shutter open longer, so they get these white clouds like they're going over the land, and it's just beautiful, So you can create pictures that aren't there.
Yeah, absolutely, and tell the story in a way that has motion and action, even though it's just a still. Hey, Jay, I've got an email here from Rick in Washburn. He loves to go to concerts, but, and I'm sure you know this, most concerts don't allow professional cameras with detachable lenses in, so Rick ends up using a cell phone, and he wants to know if there's any cell phones that you think have better quality for pictures. Are there point-and-shoot cameras that are good that he could get in through security through a concert? How would you take pictures in Rick's situation?
Well, that's if they allow no cameras, that's kind of a tough call, and we don't sell phones, so I wouldn't want to tell them to, buy the latest iPhone, but I don't know how to answer that, really.
I don't think there's probably not a good answer to that. But I remember with the advent of digital cameras that the pixel size or pixel rate used to be a big thing when I'm looking at these digital cameras. Jay, what should I be looking for in terms of the quality that they can produce?
Well, I would probably say in the last 5 years, there isn't such a thing as a bad camera made. Hmm. 15 years ago, you probably had a 3.2 megapixel and a 5 megapixel, and it went to a 10. Now they've gone over the board. You don't really need it. It's kind of like, let's say you bought a car, okay, and Lee, you bought the car, and you said the speedometer says you can only go 60 miles an hour. You say, oh, gee, 60, but it says 70, but now you get another car, and it says your speedometer says 120 miles an hour, okay? well, you feel pretty good about that. Are you ever going to use 120? Probably not. Now, you wouldn't go out and say to, hey, honey, you know what? I want to buy this car because it says 170 miles an hour. It's better than the 120, but you're not going to use it. And that's kind of what's happened in our industry. All of these cameras are so good. They're like the car that goes 170 miles an hour. They don't need more. If any, you know, I mean, they don't. They're all so good. It just becomes the features you have on each of the cameras that are the big thing.
What's the best way to take care of your camera?
Well, basically, you always want to have a case to put it in. I would highly recommend on your lens, which is the most important part of the camera, too, would be putting a protection filter on, because that really is extremely good, because the lenses are expensive and you don't want to hurt them. And the other thing is what we call their wraps that they just came out with. You wrap the camera and they have some kind of a clinging to them, so you wrap them in there like that. Then you can throw them in your bag, and boy, do they work nice. You know, they sell for about $14 or so for a wrap, and they really are neat.
Yeah, you just said throw a camera, and I thought that's something Jay Retchman would never say, but if you get the wrap on it, it sounds pretty safe.
Sure, it's very good.
Ted in Cottage Grove emailed and wants to know if there is a photo printer that you recommend.
We don't sell printers, so mm-hmm. I know Canon has a very good printers, and I guess I would recommend Canon only because we deal with a company and they're very, very good. So,
what are some of the classes that you have available at Camera Casino in Oshkosh, Jay?
Well, we have basically one-on-one classes, Lee, because Ooh. We used to do like group classes, but the problem with the group classes, if somebody comes in and has a Sony and somebody has a Panasonic, and then they say, where is that? And we spend about 10 minutes trying to show them where it is on his camera. The rest of the class has to sit there and, you know, twiddle their fingers, you see. So we decided that even though it's more economical for us to, you know, just to have 30 people there or 10, it just doesn't seem to help the customer. So we've gone to one-on-one class because that way they're bringing their camera in. We go through it and we ask them, what do you want to learn? And some of them will take the class twice because they'll say things like, you know, I really learned a lot, but I forgot a lot, you know.
Right. And it happens.
And so therefore, I didn't realize my camera did all of these things. So the one-on-ones really work the best.
Right, especially considering where cameras are today with all the bells and whistles that are available, and yet with the automatic feature that allows you to just point and click right out of the box, who knows what it can do unless you find out somebody, if you find somebody who knows what it can do.
And the other thing is when we do a class, we do it with PowerPoint, and we have it there. So we have, I think it's like 80 pictures on there. So what we say, you know, here's a picture, and they go, oh, wow. And now here's how we did it.
Yes.
Okay, and then we go to the next one. Here's how we did it. So they see maybe a before and after, and that way that's the kind of pictures I wanted to get. I was always wondering how they do that stuff. Then we can talk about that a little longer for them.
Jay Retchman, our guest, owner of Camera Casino on Main Street in Oshkosh. And let's go to John in La Crosse with a DSLR question. John, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I've got a digital SLR, and if I use the eyepiece, it's better to use that in bright light situations. It doesn't focus right. It just appears to be fuzzy, even with the autofocus. If I use the viewfinder on the back, then it's just fine. I was wondering if you have any ideas on what's the matter here.
What camera is it, just out of curiosity?
It's a Canon EOS Rebel.
Okay, E2i. And it's a digital camera?
Correct.
Okay, and you're saying that if you take pictures, it's out of focus a little bit. But if you look at the back of your, you know, through the viewfinder, you're saying that it looks sharp or it's not sharp there?
It's sharp on the viewfinder. It's not sharp through the eyepiece, but
okay.
The pictures come out fine.
Okay, yeah. Okay, if it's not sharp on the eyepiece, there's a little, it's called an... you can dial in your diopter, and a lot of people are not even aware of it. It's right next to the viewfinder, and it's because some people have glasses, some people don't. You can take your glasses off, and then you can dial it to. It's almost like going to a doctor. Is it better this way or better that way? Huh. So the companies that made that available. And sometimes that gets moved along the way because people, you know, grab the camera a different way, and all of a sudden they don't realize they even did that, you know. And then all of a sudden you go, well, it used to always work, but now it doesn't. And I'm sure that's probably what it is on your camera.
There you go, John. Thank you so much for the call. Do we still use film in cameras? Are there still cameras that use film that gets developed, Jay?
I think some of your friends have come in recently.
So WPR is still using old-fashioned film is what you're saying.
Yeah.
So, and
well, I'll tell you, Lee, we do have, I would say the people that are under 25, and because they've grown up in a digital era, they have curiosity on their mind. So they'll come in and they'll say, do you have any used cameras here? And we say, yeah, we got some film ones. And, you know, they can pick those up for like $35, $45.
Right.
And they'll say, I want to try this. And then they get a kick out of, you know, and what I see there is they take more time to take the picture. You know, with digital people, they just, you know, it takes 20 frames a second, you know, and stuff like that. And then they complain about they took 2,000 pictures over the weekend, and now they got to look at them all.
So do you develop film at Camera Casino?
We do. We do develop film. We make enlargements, any big size. We do metal. We do canvas. And we print. Our number one thing is printing off phones. We do a lot of printing off phones. People come in with their phone. They usually can't figure out how to do it.
Right.
So we usually sit down with them, and then we say, well, here, we'll show you what to do. You know, they don't. Usually they won't say, let me write that down. They just come back the next time and they say, is Michael around? Last time.
With 52 years under your belt, Jay, what do you see as the future of photography? You talk about the 25-year-olds and the return to film cameras. What's next?
Well, I think that people are starting to come back a little bit to it. Mm-hmm. You know, in the state of Wisconsin right now, we have 5 camera stores. We're almost like a... You know, it's almost like there's nothing left anymore. We have a couple in Milwaukee, one in Madison, basic camera company, and then we have one in Green Bay, and then there's us. But a lot of them have gone out of business because of the digital and the phones and all that. But people are coming back, and they're starting to understand that there is more to it than a phone, and that they can use long lenses, and it's a hobby. You know, I always say, you know, the guy has a hobby. You know, he goes and he says... you know, he hunts, he fishes, and he golfs, and those are all very expensive hobbies. And the wife says, I don't have a hobby, so she becomes the history taker, and she says, I want to have something. And we find that about 60% of our business is for ladies because they need a hobby, and they're really enjoying it. They're also the historians in the house. They're the soccer moms. They take the pictures of the kids, and they take the pictures of family reunions and all that, and that's all so important. And, you know, that's how we see it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's capturing a moment in time that is then there for you forever. And the other thing I've noticed, and I think we're going to get into this a little bit with our next guest, Jay, is the sort of access you can get when you have a camera around your neck. The places you can go, the things that you can see.
Yes, you can.
Yeah. Jay, I want to thank you so much and for joining us today. And I very much hope we have this opportunity to speak again. Thank you.
All right, Lee, it was really nice talking to you. You made me feel at ease.
Well, it's mutual, Jay, and I look forward to the opportunity again. I remember taking photography in high school. I remember how much fun it was. I remember the smell of the dark room. And I remember it was easier for me to try to tell a story in words, obviously, than it was through a picture. But oh, so much fun to try to find a way to tell a story in one instant through a photograph, which is why we turn to our next guest. When we continue, Jim Kepnick, also based out of Oshkosh, has gone around the world with his camera, has received international recognition. We'll talk about the life and times of a photojournalist from Wisconsin when we continue. Thanks again to Jay Ratchman for joining us today, owner of Camera Casino on Main Street in Oshkosh. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show.
A picture of you. Your birthday suit. All I want is a photo in my wallet, a small remembrance of something.
Blondie on WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and we're spending this hour with photography, photographers, and our next guest, a photojournalist whose camera has taken him around the world. Jim Kepnick's based out of Oshkosh. You can find him online at kepnickphotography.com. You've also seen his pictures in Our Wisconsin magazine, not to mention Life, Time, Men's Journal, People, and Popular Mechanics. His work has been acknowledged internationally, and he has gone around the world and back again. Jim Kepnick, it is a pleasure to have you on the Larry Mueller Show today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Lee, and thanks for having me.
You were also the chief photographer for the EAA in Oshkosh for almost 30 years. What got you started in photography?
Well, it was always something when I was a kid to play with a camera. It was just interesting to see the pictures you could get. But, and I think this got mentioned before, I caught part of your interview with Jay Ratchman, and that's my favorite camera story in Oshkosh.
Awesome.
But high school chemistry class, they had a photography segment of it, and learning how to develop film was really something, watching that picture come up.
Mm-hmm.
So that got me going, and the movie Blow Up was a big thing for a lot of us back in the late 60s to want to take pictures, to, you know, and that was sort of a photojournalism thing where he, in the beginning, he's in a coal mine taking pictures, and I just wanted to do something like that. So it just snowballed after that, taking just nature pictures. And then there was an opportunity to work for the Oshkosh Northwestern in the late 70s. So I helped out the correspondent, then I became the correspondent and photographer. From there, I became an assistant editor for the regional area, and finally a photographer.
Is photojournalist still a viable career? With the advent of artificial intelligence, a lot of people and a lot of careers are asking themselves that question, but I just can't for the life of me see where AI could ever take the place of what you do, Jim Kepnick.
I don't think AI is ever going to take over photojournalism, because that's documentation. It's telling a story. It's capturing a feeling and you know, trying to do it in one picture or possibly a photo layout. So I don't think it's ever, there's an ethics involved in that. So I don't think AI is ever going to do that. I think for advertising, AI has its possibilities. And it depends how you define AI. Are you totally creating an image? Are you totally putting something that doesn't belong in? Or are you just, you know, taking out something distracting or taking out spots, or, you know, just a little cleanup? So there's different levels of it.
Jim, where has your career taken you? What are some of the strangest places, some of the oddest sights that you've been able to capture with your camera?
Probably the best for me was going to Vietnam with Old Glory Honor Flight out of northeastern Wisconsin. Had a two-week trip to Vietnam with Vietnam veterans back in 2019. So that was really something to go back there. And it was really something for me because when I started my career at the Northwestern, the Vietnam War was passed, but a reporter had given me a book by David Kennerly called Shooter, and David was a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer in Vietnam, really captured my attention, and it made me want to follow that the path that he had. So going back to Vietnam and seeing some of the places where he shot at was really, you know, something for me.
And you can see part of Jim's portfolio online at his website, kepnickphotography.com. And you talk about the trip to Vietnam, the 2019 Old Glory Honor Flight. And you also mentioned earlier about how you look to capture an emotion through a camera lens. Tell me a little bit about what you mean by that and how you tried to capture that emotion when you were in Vietnam, Jim.
You know, some of it is just being aware. It takes practice. You know, it's something I may have been pretty good at in the beginning, but it's something you hone, I think. And it's just always being aware of what's going on. To me, it is, of what's going on around me. You know, subtle glances, if I can anticipate an expression by somebody or an action or something like that, just being prepared to try to capture that.
The moment, you're trying to find that moment, the little insight, the little look, that glimpse, that instant and make it permanent.
Exactly.
Yeah. You were actually honored by for your work by the United Nations back in 2023. What did that acknowledgement mean to you, Jim?
That was probably the biggest award I've ever gotten, or you know, something that really affected me inside. It was offered over my my 45 years of photography, kind of based on you know, all of my work, and to be up there with some of the people that also got the awards or have gotten the awards before. Some of those people have been my heroes ever since I started. So, you know, it was beyond words, actually.
To be elevated to the level of your heroes, the UN's International Photographic Council's motto is "Peace through photography, the universal language." That certainly speaks to me, Jim.
And it was, you know, I've done a lot of airplane work with EAA, you know, almost 30 years. That was the bulk of my career. But I still think underlying that, it was the people. It was always something Paul Poberesny, the founder of EAA, he would always say, you know, it's not about the airplanes, it's about the people. And I think as I progressed with my time there, I got to shooting more portraits of people and more interactions rather than just an airplane in the sky. And when I left in 2012, it gave me the opportunity to pursue that even further.
I'm just curious on a technical aspect, Jim, and you, again, I invite everybody to see Jim's work at kepnickphotography.com. How do you capture those planes in midair? Are you up there as well? And I, you know, we talked earlier about aperture and shutter speed, and I'm wondering the technical aspects of capturing a flight midair. And you've got some fighter jets that seem to be breaking the sound barrier as you take that picture. How do you get that shot?
Well, the jets are usually on the ground, so we're using long telephoto lenses and really fast shutter speeds, and trying to pan them when they come by, which at the speed they're going is a little difficult. There's a little luck involved in this. And the nice thing with digital is that after they make a pass, you can take a quick look and see you got the shot. So when they come back again, you can make some minor adjustments. The other airplanes, I am up in another airplane shooting them at. I really don't know the distance we're at. It's a safe distance.
Yes.
You know, safety is the first thing that comes with air-to-air photography because neither one of us want to have an accident up there. But it's, you know, I kind of, you know, I use the word hone, but I kind of honed that over my whole career at EAA. We didn't really have anyone to teach us that.
Right.
Carl Schuppel and I were the first two employees up here in photography, and we kind of learned it on our own and tweaked it. And little by little, we got it. So, you know, it was where we thought it was a nice art. You know, we thought we were really doing some good work.
Do you do any post-editing or post-production in your photography, Jim?
I do a lot of it. But I hope when you look at a picture, you don't say it doesn't look like you did.
Right.
You know, I try to make it subtle. I don't want to oversaturate the colors or over add too much clarity so it looks too rough. Unless I'm doing like a black and white portrait, and I may really up the clarity and add some grain so it's got a, you know, a gritty look to it. But basically, you want to do it so that you know, it's like ever since I worked at the newspaper, we always did a burn around the edges, a little vignette, because that was to subtly move your eye inward.
Huh.
And I still do that to this day.
Huh.
And it's very subtle. Most people aren't going to see it.
Right.
But if you saw me on the computer when I drag that, you go, oh, yeah, it is visible, but it's not something you're going to notice, I don't think.
You've also done advertising photography, which to me is just, having seen a little bit of it, absolutely magic. And understandable when you look at a hamburger in a commercial versus the hamburger you get through the drive-thru. It is an art form and then some. It is a science, too, evidently. Tell us a little bit about photographing food and the advertising aspect of your work, Jim, and what's it like in that marketing scheme?
Well, I think it's changed a lot from back in the 80s and the 90s. I think I almost want to say that was the heyday of a lot of this. You know, you had to really be specialized in what you're doing and have a studio and have all these lights and medium format cameras or 4x5 cameras. And, you know, technology, digital cameras, LED lights have made it a lot easier for a lot more people to do photography like that. I think iPhones too. I mean, look on Facebook or Instagram at all the food pictures.
Yeah.
Some look like iPhone pictures. Other ones look really good.
Yeah.
You know, the technology in a phone is there and some of the filters you can apply. So, you know, a lot of people are doing this, but the biggest thing for me is I have to please the client. I have to please the art director. If I'm shooting photojournalism or sports, I'm pleasing myself in most cases, but now I've got to please somebody else. And that can be difficult and, you know, they'll make changes and you've got to try to make that show up in the picture,
sure.
Whether it's a lighting change or a position change or something.
But back to that Instagram for a second, Jim, maybe you can help out a little bit here. I've seen the same thing you've seen, a large disparity in the quality of food photographs on Instagram. So what's your suggestion and tips for helping people take better food pictures?
Good question. You know, if your phone has a portrait mode, you may try that because that's going to blur the background out a little bit more.
Nice.
As long as you don't, you know, you don't want to blur the food out, but blurring the background out gives some nice separation. I actually do a lot. I've got an iPhone, and I actually do a lot of editing on it. You know, the basic app is set up for adding a little vignette, for sharpening, for changing the color. And so many times when I post on Instagram, I'll just hit the auto, you know, fix everything, little button right in the front. And for Instagram, it works better. If I'm, you know, the picture looks great on my computer, but it looks terrible if I just put it on Instagram. So I found when I just hit the little auto button, it brightens it up and adds a little warmth to it, and it just looks better when it's on social media.
Photojournalist Jim Kepnick, our guest. His work has taken him around the world, and his work has also been acknowledged by the United Nations. He's based out of Oshkosh, and if you have questions for our photojournalist, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Larry's back tomorrow, and it's all about your health tomorrow from 11 to 1. From head and neck surgery to stem cell therapy to the hidden costs of ageism. It's all coming up tomorrow with Larry Mueller right here on WPR News. Right now, we're talking to Jim Kepnick, a photojournalist based out of Oshkosh, specializing in aviation, sports, documentary photography. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. A quick email from Dawn, who says there's an Appleton nonprofit, PhotoOp, that's focused on all forms of photography, digital film, processing, digital techniques, offering programs for the general public and through schools at all levels. Coming up on Friday, October 17th, that's this Friday, they have a gallery showing of 23 photographers with entries that were submitted via a blind jury process. It is their annual fundraiser, PhotoOp, Appleton nonprofit, this Friday, October 17th, and thank you, Dawn. We'll go next to Charles in Oshkosh. Charles, good afternoon.
Hey, how you doing? Hi, good. Jim. I just wanted to comment that I was a journalism student at UW Oshkosh when Jim was at the Northwestern, and I worked as a stringer, and he gave me my first telephoto lens. And I've always appreciated that, but coached me up quite a bit. I just wanted to get his feedback, and I listened to the first segment on Camera Casino, too. And in my career, I think the biggest change in photography was the advent of autofocus and auto exposure, which made it so much easier for anybody to get a pretty good picture. When I started out, you had to really know what you were doing, setting an f-stop and choosing the right shutter speed, and it just took all of that guesswork out of that. And I wonder if Jim had a comment on that over his long career.
Yeah, the value of autofocus and auto exposure, Jim. And Charles, thanks so much for calling.
You know, I didn't realize how difficult it was shooting sports with manual focus until autofocus came out. And even though it was pretty laggy in the beginning, you know, it just made such a dramatic difference. And these days, it's so fast and will track a subject, will track eyes, that not that you don't get out-of-focus pictures now, mm-hmm. you know, once in a while, it's not perfect, but it is just so much easier. And not to mention, you know, maybe the eyes are getting a little older, too, after a few decades. So, you know, autofocus, I think, is just such a great feature.
And Charles talked about knowing you way back in the day as a student at UW Oshkosh. And what's the path like for a photojournalist career these days, Jim? And what would you say to somebody who loves what they do but would love even more to find a way to get paid to do it?
You know, I think there are opportunities out there. Back when I was at the newspaper, what's interesting is Gary Klein was at the university back in those days. He's been in Sheboygan for over 30 years. I'm trying to think of some of the other photographers I know in the area that were active back then and they're still active now doing something. It's the only thing I am sad is not seeing too many people following their footsteps. I'm not seeing a lot of kids out there doing this, but there are opportunities with papers, especially shooting sports. You know, that seems to be a place where someone starting out can usually get something published. You know, I want to say it's so much fun. You may not make a huge amount of money at it, but I find it so satisfying. You know, it could be like writing. You know, it's you're not going to make a fortune, but you'll find it in your heart. You know, you've got a passion for it.
Yeah, but also that camera around your neck is kind of sometimes an all-access pass. It seems to me that you can get places with your camera that I would never be able to get.
You know, I loved that back in the early days of the newspaper, and that was something in Dave Kennerly's book that he mentioned that, you know, being able to cross a police line. Mm-hmm. And in those early days, the police and the firemen knew who I was. And it was easy. They just let me through, and they knew I wasn't going to do something stupid, and I was going to take okay pictures, and you know, that worked out good. NEA was the same way. Everybody knew who I was, and they knew I was going to follow the safety rules and everything. You know, so that is sort of nice to just be able to walk in, and it's an ego thing, and you know, there's this part of me that wants to say, well, you know, it doesn't matter, but no, it is. Every once in a while, you got to have a little something like that to stroke your ego. And that's one of them.
Yeah.
That and getting a really good picture that you like.
But also, it gives you access that gives your camera access that automatically gives everybody else that sees those photographs access. So you are, in essence, a conduit for everybody else to get a little insight.
That's a really good point.
And so we've all got cameras. We've all got cell phones. They've all got cameras. And yet very few of us are actually photographers, Jim Kepnick. So I would like to know from you what we could do, each and every one of us, to maybe, you know, brush up on our skills a little bit, take a little bit of a better picture that we can share with others that tells a little bit of a better story. What are your suggestions?
I think number one is, you know, shoot a lot, even if you're on a cell phone. I'm trying to think of a good subject, but shoot 5 pictures, shoot 10 pictures, so you've got some to go through, and then edit, find the best one. I see too many things on social media where it just doesn't look like that great of a picture. So, you know, I'll go to a sporting event and shoot 2,000 pictures.
Whoa.
And I usually will edit it down to 20 that I like. And 20 that show the action or the emotion and have good composition. And, you know, that's a pretty low percentage, but that's kind of what it works out to be for me. You know, in the old days, we used to say if you had one good picture on a roll of film, and now it's, you know, we're shooting thousands of pictures, but add it down to get your best ones, and then don't put 50 pictures up on social media. Put 2 or 3 or 4 or 5. You know, depending on the event, I just did a thing for downtown Oshkosh over the weekend, and I think I put 30-something up because this was more advertising for them. Mm-hmm. So that's fine. But if I'm doing you know, something that's a little more artsy, I don't want to put up 50 or 60 pictures. Narrow it down so that people are going to see your best.
What's left in Jim Kepnick's career? Do you have a bucket list as a photojournalist? Are there still moments that you are looking to capture or things that you want to see through your lens?
Well, I do a lot with Old Glory Honor Flight, and mm-hmm. now they have an umbrella organization called Missions of Honor. We just came back from New York from last week, a four-day retreat with veterans. So photographing veterans and the emotion and that is a nice ongoing thing for me. Even though we go to the same places, it's different every time because the veterans are different.
You want to talk about a picture telling a story worth a thousand words, the face of a veteran. And I've had the absolute honor of being part of an honor flight before, and the amount, the just gamut of emotions that veterans go through on these honor flights, it runs the spectrum, and it really is, capturing that feeling, it's all feeling on those honor flights, Jim.
It is, and it's good to give back,
yeah,
and be part of this. But if I had, you know, personally one place, I want to go to Death Valley. I want to shoot sand dunes with deep shadows and, you know, and going in the winter where it's not, you know, 100 and some degrees, where it's
sure.
maybe a little more comfortable. But that's the one thing on my bucket list. And number two is we go to New York. My wife and I go to New York once or twice a year, just because I love shooting on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So going back to New York is always a big thing too.
And what is it about? It's got to be all the people, right? It's just got to be there. Everybody's got a story to tell, and there you can capture each and every one of them if you catch them in the right instant.
There are so many, you know, photo opportunities that it blows the mind. And and you find a new neighborhood, and all of a sudden there's something new. You know, you think you want to shoot all these major highlights in the city, but you could spend a day in one little city block because there's so many different things to photograph.
And what about in Wisconsin for you, Jim? Outside of the EAA and almost your 30 years as a chief photographer there, where in Wisconsin do you find it?
You know, I have a fellow photographer that, Art Eichmann, and he and I have this thing, and it'll be starting pretty soon because the sun is coming up later, which we like, so we don't have to get up so early in the morning. But we will go, we'll start off going to lighthouses, Port Washington, Kewaunee, and shooting lighthouses at dawn. And it becomes, you know, a great chance to drive and talk about, you know, not F-stops, but why we feel what we do about photography, to hopefully take some really good pictures when the sun comes up, and then find a coffee shop and sort of debrief about the whole thing over coffee and rolls.
Shooting lighthouses at dawn could be the name of your autobiography, Jim. I want to thank you so much for joining us today and giving us a little bit of an insight in the life of a photojournalist based out of Oshkosh. Jim, it's a pleasure to meet you, and I hope we get a chance to talk again. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
As mentioned, Jim Kepnick, photojournalist, based out of Oshkosh, whose favorite camera shop, by the way, is Camera Casino, who we spoke to earlier, specializes in aviation with almost 30 years at the EAA, sports and documentary photography. And I want to thank him for joining us. Want to thank you for being a part of our show today, as well as the members of the Larry Mueller Show team, Clara Neipert, Joel Patinaw, Jeff Robbins, executive producer Jill Nadeau, all make it possible. I'm Lee Rayburn, filling in for Larry today. Larry Mueller returns tomorrow, right here on WPR News.